This time on your weekly constitutional.
After Maria, there's some estimate put in the number of Puerto Ricans who have left so far, over 100,000 Puerto Ricans in 50 days. What is expected is that probably another 500,000 Puerto Ricans would leave the island in the following 2-3 years, which is going to be devastating for the economy because most of the people who are leaving are people in their prime.
After the recent devastation wrought by multiple hurricanes in the Caribbean, many Americans are asking, what exactly is this island we call Puerto Rico? Who are the people who live there? And what's our obligation to help them? We'll speak with Harry Frankie Rivera, who's an expert on the topic. I'm Stuart Harris. It's your weekly constitutional. And this week, it's about Puerto Rico.
Stay tuned for your weekly constitutional, a weekly discussion of interesting constitutional issues from gay rights to gun rights. YWC is produced in partnership with the Robert H. Smith Center for the Constitution at James Madison's historic home, Montpelier, and is hosted by Stuart Harris, who teaches constitutional law at Lincoln Memorial University's Duncan School of Law. And it's starting now.
After the recent and devastating series of hurricanes in the Caribbean, which destroyed much of the island of Puerto Rico. If you were like me, you not only felt sympathy for the people who live there, but a certain degree of curiosity. You've heard of Puerto Rico. Maybe you've even visited Puerto Rico. I was there once briefly many decades ago. But how much do you really know about this island, this place that is part of the United States, but not necessarily part of the United States? It's not actually a state. But if it's not a state, then what exactly is it? And how did it get to be whatever it is? And what's its future? I called up Harry Frankie Rivera. He's a professor and an expert on the subject of Puerto Rican history. And he's going to tell us all about how Puerto Rico came to be part of our country and what perhaps its future will be.
My name is Harry Frankie Rivera. I'm an associate professor of history at Bloomfield College.
And where's Bloomfield College?
New Jersey.
Are you from Puerto Rico originally?
I'm from Puerto Rico originally, and it was in my late stages of graduate school that I started to study Puerto Rico. Before that, I studied United States, Europe, military history.
Well, as you know, most Americans don't know nearly as much as perhaps they should about Puerto Rico, and that includes me. I've got a lot more ignorance than I do knowledge about this. So I wonder if you could just give us the big picture. What is Puerto Rico? Where did it come from? Why is it associated with the United States? What is its current status? Why don't we just start at the beginning and tell the story?
Okay. The year is 1493 when Columbus arrived to Puerto Rico, which its inhabitants call it Boricán, the Taíno, a branch of the Arawak family. And it's not until 1508 in which the colonization of Puerto Rico begins with Juan Ponce de León, who is going to eventually go to the Florida seeking for the fountain of youth, probably looking for wealth. So Puerto Rico, since its very beginning, wasn't really in the radar of the Spanish colonial authorities, right? They were looking for trade, they were looking for gold and silver, and there wasn't much of that in Puerto Rico, and to be honest, in most of the Caribbean. So the Spaniards were more interested in continuing to find that passage to the real Indies for trade, right? But then eventually they stumble into Mexico, and what is now Peru and Bolivia. They defeat the Aztecs and the Mayas, and they find mountains of gold and silver. So now the Americas are important, and to protect that gold and silver that is being extracted from what is now Mexico, Bolivia, and Peru, what you have is that Puerto Rico becomes important as a station, as a key in the defense of the galleon route back to Spain. So Puerto Rico, from the very beginning, from an abandoned colony and afterthought, becomes important to Spain as a military colony. And it's going to be a military colony until the Spaniards lose their sovereignty over the island in 1898 during the Spanish-American War. 400 years of military colony. I mentioned it because this is really important in the history of Puerto Rico, the military nature of the colony, which meant that other sectors of the economy, especially the agricultural sector, took much more time to develop than in other colonies. If we fast forward to 1898, we have the United States intervenes in the Cuban Wars of Independence. When the war is coming to an end, the Spanish fleet in Manila in the Philippines has been destroyed. The war in Cuba is basically over. Theodore Roosevelt is, as one of the Rough Riders in Cuba, he's really excited about how the war is going on, and he communicated with his friend, Senator Henry Cabot Lodge, and after telling him the good news, he explicitly says, "Don't make peace until we take Puerto Rico." And the senator replies back, basically saying that, "Don't worry, that's in the works." And a week after, or 10 days later, the United States invaded Puerto Rico, even though the Spaniards had been trying to end the war by diplomatic means, giving up Cuba, in Cuba's independence, the Philippines, and trying to keep Puerto Rico, because those were the last colonies of the former vast Spanish Empire.
I don't think most Americans know much about the Spanish-American War, and I found it intriguing that you referred to it as the Cuban War of Independence. So that was really what was going on, wasn't it? Spanish colonies were revolting against Spain.
Yes. In the Philippines, you had an ongoing war against Spanish sovereignty. The same is happening in Cuba. In Cuba, by 1897, the Cuban rebels are well aware that it's a matter of time for the Spanish military to collapse. And the funny thing is that the Spanish military, they know it too. Right, their supreme commander Valeriano Weyler, he writes as much in his memoir. He knows that the war is lost. So the Cuban rebels have been trying for the United States to recognize them as the legitimate government of Cuba and to end the weapons embargo so they can obtain weapons more freely and from the United States, and they want to end this embargo because it actually favors Spain, right? It prolongs the war. So what they want from the U.S., the Cuban rebel, is recognition and to end the trade embargo. But when the United States finally intervenes as a neutral belligerent, not even as allies of the Cuban rebels. And basically, after ending the war, the United States remains in Cuba, force an amendment on the Cuban Constitution giving the United States extraordinary powers over Cuba. So Cuba doesn't become fully independent either. It kind of becomes a protectorate of the United States. It comes to be under the sphere of influence of the United States. Part of this war, right, this Cuban War of Independence and this Filipino War of Independence that came to be known as the Spanish-American War, right? Mm-hmm. Part of this war is that the United States is expanding. It's expanding its navy, it's expanding its economy, it's coming out of a recession, and it's, the main economic and military ideology dictates that the strength of the United States is based on its capacity for trade. But trade has to grow, and trade is going to lead to competition, and to that competition is going to lead to war. So the United States should secure the trade routes by creating a formidable navy. What happened? The navy runs on coal. It's bulky. It's really not that efficient. So to run the navy throughout the world, they need coal stations, and Puerto Rico and Guantanamo and Hawaii and many islands are needed to set up those coal stations, which are going to allow the U.S. Navy to patrol the sea trade routes. So, and that's where Puerto Rico come into play.
So they're using Puerto Rico, the United States is using Puerto Rico the same way that Spain was, basically, as a base, as a military base to protect its wider interests.
In a much modern way, but yes.
Growing up in the United States, we always heard, remember the Maine, that the battleship Maine was blown up and that somehow justified our intervention in this war. And I must admit that I always wondered as a youngster, since we didn't know exactly who blew the battleship up, what exactly were our war aims other than to avenge this particular ship? What you're describing sounds like a naked power grab.
In a way, it is. I mean, at this point in history, the world is actually divided among empires. The, mm-hmm. the whole world is ruled by empires. The world is becoming too small because of the technologies developed by the West, which had allowed Western countries to actually penetrate Africa, Southeast Asia, to conquer India. So the world is becoming smaller. There's economic competition that, as Carnegie Mellon and Admiral Alfred T. Mahan, they say, this is going to lead to war, and we need to patrol the sea routes, and we need to prepare for this. So it's not just the United States. It's that Spain has become so weak as a power. It's not even a secondary power. It's a tertiary power. So the United States kind of, when it comes to national security, they fear that Spain has become so weak that any other European power may come and encroach in the Caribbean by taking the Spanish colonies.
They're filling a power vacuum. And you also mentioned Admiral Mahan. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think he's the author of that famous book, The Effect of Sea Power on History.
Yes.
And that was a very influential book. And basically, it was saying that you need to control the sea lanes, or somebody else will.
Exactly. And he's going to be the one who pushes for the creation of the Naval Academy in the United States. He's going to be president, and he's going to be his president, I think, for almost a decade, if not more. He's going to be the president of the American Historical Association, pointing history when history actually matters. And he was well respected, right? And he's going to be so influential. Senators, captains of industry, most of, actually, the top ranking naval officers are going to either study under him or his doctrine. So he's really influential.
He's very influential. In fact, I seem to recall that I read about him when I was reading about another Roosevelt, Franklin Roosevelt, who, like Teddy Roosevelt, served a time as Assistant Secretary of the Navy. And I think they were both profoundly influenced by Mahan's perspective on this, and both favored a large and strong Navy.
I would say that even FDR was even more into than Teddy Roosevelt in having a powerful Navy. FDR, he was a Navy man.
Yes, he certainly was. It's Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and this week my guest is Harry Frankie Rivera, a professor at Bloomfield College in New Jersey, who's an expert on a subject that has been devastatingly in the news lately, Puerto Rico. And now it's time to return to our discussion with Harry Frankie Rivera, who's an expert on the history and the current political status of Puerto Rico, which has been sadly in the news because of all the devastation wrought by the recent hurricanes. Before the break, we were talking about how Puerto Rico's status as a colony, both of Spain and the United States, was dictated to a great extent by its strategic position along the sea lanes in the Caribbean. The Spanish controlled Puerto Rico for hundreds of years, but all of that changed in the late 19th century during what we call the Spanish-American War. Well, now we've put this into context, so now it seems to make more sense that Teddy Roosevelt gets his Rough Riders and he goes down to Cuba and he has his adventures. And you said he wired back to Senator Lodge that we should keep the war going until we'd secured Cuba and Puerto Rico?
Until we secure Puerto Rico. Cuba is during the last days of the Cuban campaign. And he said, do not make peace until we take Puerto Rico, meaning we need boots on the ground if we're going to claim Puerto Rico as a war trophy, or in the language that is going to be known as in lieu of indemnities.
In lieu of indemnities. Oh, okay. Instead of making Spain pay us some money at the end of the war, we're just going to take her territory.
Exactly.
Okay. And the heck with the people who actually live there.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. So this is just sounding like empire building. And, there are always justifications for this. I mean, the power vacuum that Spain is leaving behind, the protection of free trade, et cetera, et cetera. But getting lost in all of this, it seems, are the Puerto Ricans themselves, who don't seem to have much to say about it. So, okay. So when do we actually take possession of Puerto Rico then?
July 25th, 1898, the American troops invaded through the southern town of Guanica. And just as they thought, they came from the southwest, because it's where you would find the most anti-Spanish sentiment, right? Mm-hmm. So they came with Puerto Rican scouts and Puerto Rican from the exile. Some Puerto Rican revolutionary came with invading forces. And as soon as they landed, the Spanish forces started retreating, and the Puerto Rican population started joining and welcoming the invading forces. So you could say that the United States was kind of fighting the way in which they fought, the way in which they invaded, and they fought this campaign in Puerto Rico is kind of, to put it this way, it's kind of like trying to win the hearts and minds of the Puerto Ricans. Mm-hmm. They declare that this is not an invasion, that this is a liberation, that property is going to be respected, civil rights, things that until very recently didn't exist in Puerto Rico. They are bringing all of that, right? And the observers, they say, yeah, the American forces, they behave admirably. And they do so because their commanders, they want to show this is a civilized nation. This may be a war, but it's not a war seeking oppression in the end. It's a war for liberation. We're going to bring freedom, the empire of freedom, right?
Okay.
And they make many promises. And the population, who hasn't been feeling that that well under Spain, they joined the American forces immediately, which makes the Spanish army defenses basically collapse. And pretty soon, the war is over. And because of the Treaty of Paris of 1899, what you have, actually 1898, what you have is that Puerto Rico is ceded to the United States. Cuba is going to be independent, but under the protection of the United States. And the Philippines became part of the United States as well. So mm-hmm. the first thing that we have, the first type of government that Puerto Rico had under the United States is a military one. The first military report states that there's not enough capable men in Puerto Rico to run a civilian government, so a military government ensues. And this is interesting because previous to the American invasion, Puerto Rico has been granted by Spain higher degree of autonomy. And they had inaugurated what is called the Autonomic Charter of 1897. It was inaugurated, the first government inaugurated around March 1898, but pretty soon martial law is declared because of the war with the United States. And it is about a week before the United States invaded the martial law is rescinded, and the government start working again. But make no mistake, this is an attempt by the Spanish colonial authorities to win the loyalty, to secure the loyalty of the Puerto Ricans. And it didn't work.
Sounds like too little, too late.
Oh, yeah. They offered the same to the Cubans, but the attitude of the Cuban was more like, are you kidding me? I'm getting independence. I don't want this deal.
So the Spanish are driven off the island. Despite some last-minute concessions, the Puerto Rican population rises up and fights alongside its own rebels, and the American forces then say, we've got to have a military government here. We don't have the personnel for a civilian government. And so the beginning of military rule under United States forces begins.
Yes.
So what happens then?
What happens is that the United States start to try to decide, okay, we have Puerto Rico. But what do we do with the Puerto Ricans, with mm-hmm. the people who live here? And there's a huge debate about whether or not they can be assimilated, whether or not they can be, I kid you not, civilized. And a lot of people say, no, these people are too racially mixed. What little culture that we may see as culture or civilization comes from Spain, which is looked upon as a retrograde place because of the currentism of Catholicism. This is how they put it. So
what was the phrase again? What was that phrase?
The obscurantism of Catholicism.
The obscurantism, of Catholicism.
Yeah.
In other words, it's some sort of mystical religion that we don't trust?
Yeah.
Oh my. So there's anti-Catholic sentiment, there's anti-Spanish sentiment, there's anti-indigenous people sentiment because there had been, as you describe it, race mixing there. These people speak Spanish. They have darker skin, perhaps, than many Europeans, and therefore they are not capable of being civilized?
Yeah, and you're missing a component. they see Puerto Ricans as they call it the unholy mix of Negro, Indian, and Spanish.
So there's African influence as well within the mix, and that's also a strike against the Puerto Ricans.
Yes.
Oh,
there's
my
talk
goodness.
About miscegenation and how bringing right. these people within the fabric of the United States is going to ruin what we know as Americans.
You know what? This is the height of the American eugenics movement. This era is when you had all sorts of racial hygiene theories out there and legitimate scientists actually buying into this theory, legitimate for their day, buying into this theory. And I can see this. I can see this in the context of the times that the ruling class, at least in the United States, is not going to want to mix these races in. Oh, my. So they'd, in other words, to use a different analogy, they'd taken a big bite of Puerto Rico and now they were not able to swallow it.
Well, some historians put it that this way. The United States, they wanted the cage, but not the birds.
Hmm. That's right.
Right now they have the cage. They don't know what to do with the birds, right?
Exactly. Well, you know, contrast this with North America. There was, of course, that terrible Holocaust that occurred after first contact between Europeans and indigenous peoples. And throughout much of North America, just millions and millions of people died before European settlement really even took place. And that sort of cleared the continent of many of the indigenous peoples without a shot being fired. But you're telling me that in Puerto Rico, there was a thriving mixed population. And so, as you say, they wanted the cage. They wanted the island, but they didn't want the people on it. Did they ever consider mass deportations or something of that sort? Were there ever solutions of that sort proposed?
No, but there's something really interesting because I don't know, you know, about the Indian industrial schools to kill the Indian Seda men that I created in the United States around this, from I think it started in the 1870s.
I know a little bit about it, but please share it with us.
So these schools are kind of like the, we need to put this in historical perspective. This is, even though today this looks as something borderline criminal, this is the most benevolent approach followed by the military and the Bureau of Indian Affairs with regard of what to do with the native population. Most of the people would say that the only good Indian is a dead Indian, right? Mm. You have heard that before.
I've heard that expression, yeah.
So this army officer who fought alongside Indian scouts in the frontier, he say no. The Indian can be safe. We only need to kill the Indian to save the man under the Indian skin, right? Mm-hmm. So basically, is we can assimilate them culturally. And he convinces the government to allow for the creation of these schools. So the first one, I think, is going to be in Pennsylvania, Carlisle Barracks, and Native peoples are brought to this school to be completely assimilated, forget at very, very early age. So they don't even have a link, a connection to the language and the culture, so they can become men. The idea of killing the Indian, saving the men, right? So in Puerto Rico, the elite, as soon as the Americans arrive and the government is installed, some people propose, hey, we have these schools. Do you want to send your children? And people in Puerto Rico from the elite, mostly, they think, oh, this is kind of a university. So they start sending their kids the people doing this elite, they perceive themselves as the descendant of Europeans, as white. And then they complain that they're being treated as Indian in this school. So you have, there's even pictures of Puerto Rican students in Carlisle Barracks, and it says Puerto Rican Indians right after the bat. So there was no plan for emptying the island. Sugar Corporation.
But forced assimilation was very much on the agenda.
Yeah. What is decided is that you mentioned the eugenic movement and this what we call now pseudo-scientific racist view, which at the point at this point in history, they were mainstream. They were not considered to be pseudo-scientific, right?
Right.
So what he decided is that even though the people of Puerto Rico and the people of the Philippines are way inferior to the Anglo-Saxon, that the Puerto Ricans can be somewhat assimilated. The Philippines, in the Philippines, President McKinley decides to take the challenge of accepting the white, taking on the white man's burden, and engage in civilizational imperialism, compassionate uplifting, and they convince the public that one of the reasons we took over these places is to carry out this holy mission of civilizing the world. And they say, yeah, we're going to make something out of the Filipinos, but they will never, the Philippines were not meant to ever be incorporated into the United States, and much less the Filipinos. And in Puerto Rico, and the Puerto Ricans were considered slightly more civilized than the Filipinos. Let's see what we do with them. The idea is, again, assimilation, the concept of creating tropical Yankees start to emerge. And the United States is going to come with school, is going to bring all the structure that you find in the United States in terms of banking, postal service, public education school, and of course, military service as a way of civilizing, Americanizing the people of Puerto Rico. Kind of set up a tutelage. That's what they call it.
I'm sorry, tutelage. Okay. You mentioned a phrase a few minutes ago that I've heard before, but might be unfamiliar to some people. So I wonder if you could expand on that a bit. What is this so-called white man's burden?
Well, this is the idea that the white man, especially, and among the white men, especially the Anglo-Saxon, is superior to non-whites. And because they are superior, they have the obligation, it is their mission, to uplift, to civilize the rest of the world. And what we got here is that a mix of pseudo-scientific discourse all the time, right?
Right.
They're taking, I don't know if you're familiar with the writing of Josiah Strong, Our Country, right? He's an evangelical leader who sells over 100,000 copies in his book. What he says is that the Anglo-Saxon man has been chosen by God to uplift the rest of the world, to civilize it. So you have religious leaders saying this. You have people like Theodore Roosevelt who believe in this. You have historian, political scientists, scientists, and what they're doing basically is that they're taking Darwin's theory of the species and making it into something that it wasn't, because Darwin's theory is about how accidental evolution is, right?
Mm-hmm.
Survival of the fittest is not ordained. When these pseudoscientists and religious leaders, when these pseudoscientists, they include religion into their understanding of the origin of the species, what comes out of that is like, yeah, we have evolved and we have developed superior traits, and no one has developed better traits than the Anglo-Saxon. So the Anglo-Saxon man is better equipped to succeed and to lead the world.
That's just remarkable.
And that has happened because God preordained it.
Right.
And that's when it becomes a real problem.
Yeah, it's just fascinating. You pointed out before that when you take a scientific theory like it's commonly called Darwinism, or more properly natural selection, the theory of evolution,
when you take that and then you sort of borrow it and you put it in a social context, creating something that is known as social Darwinism, first of all, it makes no sense. Secondly, it can be used simply to justify the existing social order. You know, Darwin says survival of the fittest. We're obviously on top in our particular society, and therefore we're the fittest. And then let's throw into that mix, and obviously God approves of this because God controls everything, so he must have ordained our superiority, and therefore we're ruling through God-given rights. It is just a remarkable conglomeration of disparate ideas leading to a remarkable outcome, as we've just been describing.
Yeah, this is the golden age of civilizational imperialism.
Yeah, civilizational imperialism. That's such an interesting thing. We're going to go out and civilize the whole world. Something else you said a moment ago also struck me. Let's begin, you know, with a benchmark. You know, racism and this sort of nonsense is always bad. But as you pointed out, there are degrees of this. I mean, it's perhaps the worst sort of racism leads to genocide. When you're actually saying, you know, the only good Indian's a dead Indian, and you go out and round them up and kill them, well, that's obviously a lot worse than what we've been talking about. And it's the stuff we've been talking about, these so-called civilizing schools and all the rest of them, they are certainly not as violent and certainly not as malevolent, perhaps. In fact, maybe there is hidden in there some good intention, however misguided. But nonetheless, it's all still based on the premise that there is a superior race and an inferior race.
Definitely. And to put it this way, the way I see what happens in Puerto Rico and the project of assimilation and the civilizational projects in Puerto Rico, they're similar to that. They're similar to the Indian reservation. They're similar to the Indian industrial school, kind of kill the Puerto Rican, say the men, right? So the United States is going to come to try and transform not just the structures in the island, but even the identity and culture of the Puerto Rican to make something out of them the way they see it.
Well, this, of course, continues throughout much of the 20th century, but then eventually there's another Puerto Rican independence movement that arises, isn't there?
Yes, yes.
Could you tell us about that?
Yeah, so, okay, so Puerto Rico had the military government for over a year. In 1900, a civilian government is established, even though a military government had been established previously. Two parties formed in Puerto Rico, both seeking statehood. One of the parties, they want Puerto Rico to become a state of the island and to assimilate culturally. The other wants to Puerto Rico to join what they see as this federation of republic, right? That's how they see the United States, but keeping the Puerto Rican culture intact, right? Mm-hmm. So the way they see it, I can have a cultural identity and a political one. They're not mutually exclusive, right? Mm-hmm. So 1900 Foraker Act, this act from Congress create the first civilian government, and among the many things that it establishes is that it creates a body politic known as Citizens of Puerto Rico. Not even longer Puerto Rico, Puerto Rico. And so it creates Puerto Rican citizenship, and at the same time declares that Puerto Ricans are going to be American nationals under the protection of the United States. So you could see the way of saying this is that Congress, since the very beginning, has been involved in defining who are the Puerto Ricans in terms of their political relationship with the United States and in terms of identity, right? Mm-hmm. So this ad it doesn't work for most people. It didn't sit well with those who thought that Puerto Rico was going to be a state. It creates the basis for this idea that Puerto Rico is not going to be incorporated as a as a territory of the United States, which is the first state in becoming a state. Instead, it makes Puerto Rico an unincorporated territory, meaning that a special clause is created for Puerto Rico. And what that shows is that at that point in time, the authorities, they were not interested or thinking about the possibility of eventually extending statehood to Puerto Rico. But political leaders, it's going to take them a little bit more to fully understand this, right? Mm-hmm. And eventually there's going to be an independent movement. In 1917, it's growing, a way of crushing that independent or autonomous movement. What the United States decides to do is to finally extend U.S. citizenship to the people of Puerto Rico.
It's Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris. I'm speaking with Harry Franke Rivera, who's an expert on Puerto Rico, its history, its current status, and maybe its future. After the break, we'll finish our discussion with Harry. Stick around. And now it's time to finish our discussion with Harry Franke Rivera, who's just about to tell us how Puerto Ricans became American citizens.
So in 1917, you have Congress again passing a bill in which Puerto Ricans now are U.S. citizens and Puerto Rican nationals, kind of inverting the Foraker Act, and also extending an extended degree of self-rule to Puerto Rico. Not much, but it kind of does the trick, and the political tension in Puerto Rico kind of diffuses, and then World War I came, and nothing much is going to happen until the 1930s, which is when the nationalist movement becomes virulent, and there's kind of a shooting war in Puerto Rico between the colonial authorities and the Puerto Rican police and the nationalists. And Puerto Rico came to be known as the Island of the Caribbean.
The Ireland of Caribbean. Okay, yeah. So there's a bit of violence, there's a bit of an independence movement, and then that actually spilled over into the mainland, didn't it?
Yes, but that is not going to be until the 1950. In 1950, Public Law 600 passes, and the idea is that the Puerto Ricans are going to elect a constitutional assembly to draft a constitution in the form of a compact with the United States. Kind of like going back to that autonomous government that Puerto Rico secured from Spain in 1897 before the American invasion. It's kind of a revival of this idea. Some people say this is kind of like the dominion status within the British Empire. And these come, in the post-war era, right? World War II ended, and the United States was really interested in dismantling the official empires remaining in the world, right? Because empires are not good for free trade. So right after World War II ended, the United States put in pressure on their own allies, right? The British and the French to decolonize.
And that put us in an embarrassing situation when we had effectively what were our own colonies.
Exactly. So what to do with Puerto Rico? Well, there's a movement in Puerto Rico which has revived the idea of, for now, the political issue is not important. Our people are hungry. What we need is more self-government so we can fix this. We can feed our people. We can house our people. We can change the economy. We can go from agrarian to industrial, right? Mm-hmm. And when that happens, the people of Puerto Rico, they're going to demand independence on their own, right? Mm-hmm. So what is proposed is an in-between space, right? And that's where Public Law 600 comes in, and is touted throughout the world as a peaceful, as a democratic revolution, as a third path toward the colonization. So because this law is passed in 1950, in the eve of the voting whether or not Puerto Ricans were going to accept this deal and write the Constitution, you had the nationalist insurrection in Puerto Rico, which is going to be put down by local forces, basically Puerto Ricans fighting Puerto Ricans, and it's going to spill into the U.S. because the nationalists are going to try to kill President Truman.
Yeah.
The insurrection fails. What it actually does is that it actually works in the favor of those pushing in Puerto Rico towards Public Law 600, because the United States, the federal forces in Puerto Rico, what they did is they stepped back and watched, and they saw that the Puerto Rican local authorities, the elected officials, and the Puerto Rico National Guard and Police were enough to keep Puerto Rico stable, that they have been really quick in suppressing the insurrection. So in a way, if there were any continental Americans who were on the fence about the viability of the Puerto Rican obtaining self-rule and keeping the country stable, the way in which they handle the insurrection kind of eased their fears. Mm-hmm. So the insurrection is put down, public law is accepted in a landslide, and in 1952, Puerto Rico inaugurates its first government under that law. Now they're electing their governor and all their representatives, passing their laws, right? And it is interesting, this is around, the Constitution of Puerto Rico is approved around July 3rd or July 4th, but it's not going to become effective until July 25th, which is exactly the day in which the Americans invaded. And this is of a way of erasing the invasion and mm-hmm. the whole idea of the military occupation, right? And mm-hmm. July 25th goes from being a day in which there would be a military parade celebrating the invasion, right? Now is a day in which you celebrate the Constitution of Puerto Rico.
Okay. So this brings us up to the 1950s or 60s?
Nothing happens in a vacuum, right? Not even in history, right?
Right.
So you have the Cold War. It's in 1950, you have the Korean War. You could say that the Cold War started in 1948. So because the United States promoting Puerto Rico as a way for peaceful decolonization, right? The United States invested in Puerto Rico actually working out, like the idea of what Puerto Rico is doing to be successful, right? Mm-hmm. And there's going to be a lot of American capital, which is going to be brought to Puerto Rico, invested in Puerto Rico. And some historians call this a century of development in one decade. And Puerto Rico becomes kind of a showcase, right? A Potemkin village, but real, in which the world can see what is going, how you would fare if you align with the United States, with the capitalist bloc, right?
Okay.
And things start to work in Puerto Rico, right? But there is a problem. At this point, the economy of Puerto Rico had been so depressed that whatever you tried, was going to work, right? There was so much room for improvement, right? So mm-hmm. things start to work in Puerto Rico, and it looks like a miracle. And Puerto Rico, for the first time, came to be known as the Pearl of the Caribbean, right? A lot of mm-hmm. progress, the standard of living rises up between 1940 and 1960. In 20 years, the life expectancy of Puerto Rico increases 23 years. Things like that, and urbanization projects, industrialization, it seems like things are working. But in the 70s, it comes to a halt, right? And the 70s were kind of a really tough period for the United States, right? And
I was here then, and that was a period we call stagflation. Oil prices are rising, employment is flat, inflation is rampant, and things were not going well generally. So I guess that also affected Puerto Rico.
It did, and in terms of the global context, it seems like defeat in Vietnam is imminent. It seems that the Soviets are in the ascendancy, right? Cuba has gone, since 1959, Cuba has gone socialist and has joined the Soviet sphere, right? And mm-hmm. all of those things, these things combine to revive that idea that Puerto Rico cannot fail. And Cuba must fail at all costs. So what is done in the U.S.? A new program is created, the 93C section of the Internal Revenue Code, right? Mm-hmm. Which attract factories to Puerto Rico which are not going to pay taxes. And that is a reboot of the economy, right? Mm-hmm. But then what happens is that the Cold War ended. And by 1995, the Clinton administration, trying to pass his domestic agenda, they make a deal with the GOP-controlled Congress to eliminate the 936 section, right? Mm-hmm. In Puerto Ricans realize that that is going to be devastating for the economy. But those who want Puerto Rico to become a state, they would like to see Puerto Rico acting like a state. So they really don't defend. They really didn't defend the permanence of the 93C section, even though they knew that it would cripple the economy of Puerto Rico, right? So from 1996 to 2006, the 936 are phased out. And the GOP thought that those companies would leave Puerto Rico and come back to the United States. But no, they went to Singapore, Ireland, anywhere but the United States and its territories. So it affected the U.S. economy, and it devastated the Puerto Rican economy. So when it was inevitable, when it was obvious that the 936 would depart, subsequent Puerto Rican governors, what they did is they borrowed heavily. Why? Because Puerto Rico, since that incredible development, had continued to invest in education, right? So Puerto Rico had the infrastructure that no other country in the Caribbean and in most of Latin America had, and it had one of the highest educated workforce in the world, right? So they thought, if we continue to invest in advanced technology infrastructure, the companies are going to stay. So they battle heavily to embark in these projects, right? Mm-hmm. But by 2006, most companies have left. And that led, not unsurprisingly, to the debt and financial crisis. All the debt was accumulated to create this infrastructure project, but the factories and transnational corporations, they left anyways.
Puerto Rico's borrowing in order to invest in its economy. The investment doesn't pay off, and now they're stuck with this debt. And if I understand correctly, unlike a lot of governments in the United States, Puerto Rico is not able to declare bankruptcy.
It is not able to declare bankruptcy, and that was a decision made in 1984. Puerto Rico was excluded from Chapter 9 in 1984.
And so it really has no way to get out from under this debt like another, I mean, the city of Detroit, where I'm from, declared bankruptcy a few years ago, and it has emerged from it and is doing much better now than it was before. Puerto Rico doesn't have that, and it's got, if I recall correctly, what, something like $70 billion of debt?
Yeah, between 70, 73 billion. And one thing really interesting about this is that most of that debt, that money never made it to Puerto Rico because it has been, a lot of it is accrued interest. So as Puerto Rico started to get more and more in debt, then its credit would be downgraded, which would raise the interest, compounding the debt.
Yeah, so a terrible financial situation. And on top of all of that, then you get hit by this devastating series of hurricanes.
Yes, and Irma and Maria back to back.
I know, just horrible. And I actually have at least one Puerto Rican student I can think of off the top of my head who was terribly concerned during the hurricane and essentially went down and helped to evacuate her family members to the mainland, which, of course, Puerto Ricans can do. They can simply leave Puerto Rico and come to the mainland because they have citizenship. With little or no difficulty. I've kind of wondered whether the devastation is so extreme and whether the economic outlook there is so bleak that this series of hurricanes may simply lead to a depopulation of Puerto Rico, if other Puerto Ricans will simply come to the American mainland and never go back.
the population already had already started because of the debt crisis. Mm-hmm. About 500,000 Puerto Ricans they left the island in recent years because of the debt. Right now, after Maria, there's some estimate putting the number of Puerto Ricans who have left so far, over 100,000 Puerto Ricans in 50 days. Mm. And what is expected is that probably another 500,000 of Puerto Ricans would leave the island in the following 2-3 years, which is going to be devastating for the economy because most of the people who are leaving are people in their prime.
Right.
And right. People in their 40s are actually those who are leaving are those who can't leave, right? Mm-hmm. So the island is losing its professionals, right? From doctors, nurses, policemen, all kinds of technicians, and even their scientists, right? Our biologists, our chemists, all the people who are really needed. And Puerto Rico is even losing its soldiers and veterans, which have always been, actually since World War II, they have been a gauge to measure how well Puerto Rico is doing economically. They are actually the core of the middle class in Puerto Rico, the military veterans. And
right.
Even
I actually served with a fellow in the 80s in the Army. He was a Puerto Rican. He was in my platoon. Well, Harry, thank you so much for sharing us with us this big picture and bringing us right up to the present day. It looks like Puerto Rico has really had its ups and downs over the last few centuries, and at the moment it seems to be in a really down place. I sincerely hope that it can pick itself up again.
Well, that's what I hope to. I want to be optimistic and see that people of Puerto Rico rising up again. It's going to be incredibly hard to do it. Puerto Rico needs a concerted, sustained effort, something akin to a combination of the New Deal and the Marshall Plan, so Puerto Rico can again be a prosperous place and a place that offers the Puerto Rican a chance to make it and a chance to all those Puerto Ricans who are leaving right now because of the dire situation to come back.
And that's our show. Thanks so very much to Harry Frankie Rivera of Bloomfield College in New Jersey, who's been telling us all about Puerto Rico, its history, its past, its present, its potential future, which at the moment isn't looking too hopeful. Our executive producer is Wayne Winkler. Our scheduler is Carol Hutchinson. Our distribution engineer is Chad Barrett. Our production intern is Donald Crenshaw. Our music is by Hannibal's Elephant. Check him out on SoundCloud. My name is Stuart Harris, and remember, you are a part of the American experiment, even if some people don't think you should be.